everyone, and welcome back to Raya Affairs. My name is Nicola, and I'll be your host for this episode. Raya is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. Raya is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders, the behind-the-scenes of decision-makers, and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is Raya Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. As always, we start with a disclaimer that expressed opinions in this episode are welcome, even though they are not a direct reflection of Raya, as we specialize in unbiased writing. This episode is the sixth and last episode of our series as part of the IE Raya Summer Research Program of 2025. Raya has invited 12 IE University students to join our think tank and spend 9 weeks researching a figure from around the world to try to answer a simple question. Are they a climate leader? During the research, students have done a deep dive of the person's background, policies, and the impact of said policies in an effort to bring light to the diverse ways in which every person, no matter the role they play in society, can contribute to the global climate change policy framework. In today's episode, we will be focusing on Anthony Nyong, Director of Climate Change and Green Growth at the African Development Bank. And here with us, we have Luisa Melo and Sara Tobar. Welcome to Raya Affairs, guys. It's a pleasure to have you here, and thank you so much for joining me today. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Okay, so hi, I'm Sarah. I was born and raised in Colombia, and I am currently going into my third year studying international relations and law at IE University.
Hi, my name's Luisa. I was born in Brazil, and I'm currently going into my third year studying international relations in IE University.
Well, thank you very much, guys. Again, it's a pleasure to have you here, and it's a pleasure to meet you as well. And thank you for the introduction. And now, before we start the episode, I'll ask you to answer our usual ice-breaking question. This is a question that we ask every guest on the podcast. So could you tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world, would you want to have a conversation with, and why?
So I would love to have a conversation with Nelson Mandela. I recently had the opportunity to go to South Africa and get to know a little bit about his personal and, well, political life. He has this amazing ability to just lead with both, like, strength but also compassion. And he spent 27 years in prison, and it amazed me how he came out of that, still thinking about unity and forgiveness. And I think how he managed to turn just personal pain into collective purpose is just really amazing. And I think we can really use the same spirits today with our struggles.
I would love to have a conversation with Martin Luther King Jr. because I feel his vision, courage, and he had the ability to inspire change through nonviolence, which is something I find incredibly powerful. And I also wanted to ask how he stayed hopeful and driven in the face of so much resistance. I mean, how he managed to bring people together around is such a bold dream.
That's great. That's great, guys. Very, very nice picks. I love them. Both of them centered on political and civil rights in two different countries, but really important figures, of course. And it's always nice to hear from the different guests that we have on the podcast about their picks, who they would want to have a conversation with. And I would say in this case, I envy a little bit your picks. I would love to have a dinner with both of them as well. And thank you very much for the answers. And now I would say that we can start our conversation about your report on Anthony Nyong. And in the report, you describe him as a development-oriented climate leader. So I would like to ask you, what do you mean by this? And could you please briefly summarize his personal and professional history? And finally, in your view, what makes his approach to climate leadership unique?
Okay, sure. So Nyong, he doesn't see climate change as just environmental issue. He also sees it as a development challenge. He was born in Nigeria in 1961. And he spent his life, decades, combining both academic research, field work, and as well policy making. He earned a PhD in geographical science from McMaster University in Canada. He also worked on water security and environmental degradation in the Sahel. His turning point, which we will talk a little bit further, came when he became a lead author for the IPCC's fourth assessment report, which was in 2007. And this really highlighted Africa's vulnerability to climate change. Since 2018, he has been the Director of Climate Change and Green Growth at the African Development Bank, also known as AFDB. And he really pushes for climate strategies that create jobs, improve healthcare, and also just expand infrastructure. What is really, I think, interesting is his approach is very eclectic, holistic. He frames climate adaptation as both an opportunity for economic transformation and not just crisis management. So that's why we called him a development-oriented climate leader.
Well, thank you very much, Luisa. And now I would like to dive into your report. And unlike the other reports of this series, because of Nyong's occupation at the African Development Bank, your report does not focus on a single country, but on the African continent as a whole. And you identify three main environmental challenges that the continent of Africa faces and that are important to Anthony Nyong's climate leaderships. So those are the increasing frequency of extreme weather events, the rising health risks linked to climate change and rising temperatures, and the persistent energy poverty and inequality across the continent. And regarding extreme weather events, which include droughts, floods, heat waves, and cyclones, you explain how Nyong sees them as a central climate and development concern. So could you help our listeners understand just how devastating these events have been and why Nyong sees them not just as natural disasters, but as manifestations of broader systemic issues?
Okay, so the impact of extreme weather events across the continent of Africa are really staggering. We can start with droughts, just for some figures. So East Africa faced a very severe drought between 2020 and 2023, and it left millions of people without food, water, and also displaced like entire communities. And these droughts, they are an isolated incident. They're like part of a trend that's worsening, that threatens food security, livelihoods all across the continent. Heat waves also have broken records. So in Mali in 2024, for example, temperatures exceeded 48 degrees Celsius. And this caused a spike in health-related deaths and also brought agricultural work and outdoor labor to a halt. And this obviously damages the local economies and really affects development. When talking about floods, which is also an event that you mentioned, is also a major concern because in 2022 alone, floods affected 5.9 million people across 20 African countries. So it killed more than 1,000 and destroyed a lot of homes, infrastructure, and villages in general. Also, you can't forget like Cyclone Idai, which was in 2019, which became pretty heard of around the world. And it displaced over 1.5 million people. It wiped out roads, schools, and entire health facilities in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, as well as Malawi. So Nyong viewed these disasters differently from how they're very often portrayed. He doesn't see them as at random or natural occurrences. He frames them as symptoms of like deeper systemic problems. So things like deforestation, urban expansion that's unregulated, fragile infrastructure, and also just persistent inequality. For him, like climate resistance is more than just emergency response, so responding to the crisis. It's also about looking deeper into this root causes and improving things like land and water management, building better drainage systems, and also just being better at urban planning. Also like promoting sustainable agriculture, and these are agriculture that can sustain climate shocks. He emphasizes how it's also, this is something very critical to his speech. He emphasizes how it's very important to empower and protect the most vulnerable, which are usually women, children, because these people suffer disproportionately during this crisis. In his view, preparing for these extreme weather events is also strengthening social and economic foundations, and this will allow the communities and, as a result, the country to not only survive, but also to recover and eventually thrive again after the disasters that unfortunately occur.
And another challenge that you explore in the report is rising temperatures. And you explain how temperatures across the African continent are increasing at a rate faster than the global average, posing a wide range of threats to public health, labor productivity, food systems, and ecosystems. What are some of the effects of rising temperatures on human health in Africa, and how does NYON connect this health dimension to broader development goals? In particular, why does he see a climate-resilient healthcare infrastructure as such a critical part of climate adaptation?
Okay, so rising temperatures in Africa are having serious multi-layer effects on public health, livelihoods, and, of course, development. So the continent is warming at a rate faster than the global average, and this is amplifying both direct and indirect health threats. On the direct side, extreme heat waves are leading to heat exhaustion, dehydration and cardiovascular strain, and particularly from outdoor workers, agriculture and construction sectors, let's say, that employ millions of people. So these conditions reduce productivity, of course, they increase medical emergencies, and as a result, an undermined number of people dying from heat events and directly impact economy stability. But I feel the most insidious impacts come from climate-sensitive diseases. For example, warmer temperatures are expanding the habitats of mosquitoes and other disease carriers, like causing outbreaks of malaria and dengue in regions that historically didn't experience them, like highland areas in Kenya and Ethiopia. Rising temperatures and erratic rainfall patterns also increase waterborne disease, such as cholera, particularly in flood-prone urban slums with poor sanitation infrastructure. And we feel NYON connects these directly to broader development goals. So he argues that without strong climate resilience healthcare systems, this health crisis will reverse decades of development progress, of course. For example, when a child falls sick due to malnutrition or climate-induced disease, they miss school. And when adults are unable to work due to heat stress or illness, entire families lose that income. So NYON calls this a climate health syndemic, where climate shocks and social inequalities combine to magnify the overall burden of disease and poverty. And this is why NYON pushes for climate-proof hospitals, mobile health clinics, and better water and sanitation infrastructure, and early warning systems for disease outbreaks. In his view, strengthening healthcare in the face of climate change is not just about saving lives, but it's also about to protecting the foundation of economic growth and social stability across Africa.
Well, it seems like both of these environmental challenges have not only effects, as you perfectly explained, on the environment itself, but definitely has some consequences also on social stability, economic growth, and in general, development in a lot of African countries. And this is exactly why Anthony NYON's approach is, as we said before, really important, because it links the idea of climate action with development goals and social stability, social equality, and economic growth. And now the last environmental challenge that I would like to discuss with you is energy poverty and inequality, meaning the lack of access to affordable, reliable, and modern energy services. You argue that NYON sees energy poverty not just as a development issue, but also as a fundamental equity concern that drives inequality, limits economic opportunity, and slows progress on climate goals. Why is access to affordable and reliable energy so closely linked to inequality and vulnerability?
Okay, so energy poverty remains one of the biggest structural barriers to development in Africa, and NYON sees it as a fundamental equity issue. More than 600 million people still live without access to electricity, and over 900 million rely on polluting fuels like firewood and charcoal for cooking. And this obviously has a devastating ripple effects. So school can't function after dark, hospitals can't refrigerate vaccines or run life-saving equipment, and business face constant disruptions from blackouts or the high cost of diesel generators. Without reliable energy, people are locked out of modern education, digital tools, and economic innovation. This is also a gendered issue, because women and girls spend hours collecting firewood, are exposed to harmful indoor air pollution, and often missed out on schooling or paid work. This deepens cycles of poverty and inequality, of course, and Neong argued that solving energy poverty is essential for achieving climate goals. I mean, Africa contributes only about 3% of the global emissions, yet its lack of clean energy access forces communities to rely on inefficient and polluting fuels. And by investing in renewable energy, such as solar mini-grids, wind power, and off-grid solutions, Africa can leapfrog to a cleaner energy future while boosting development. He also calls for a just energy transition, because many African governments lack of the capital for large-scale energy infrastructure, of course, and private investors are often wary of rural markets. So Neong's vision involves blending public and private finance, supporting community-owned energy projects, and creating green jobs for young people. In his words, energy access is the foundation for upward mobility. It enables healthcare, education, entrepreneurship, and resilience to climate shocks.
Great. Thank you very much, Sarah. And now I would like to move to the next topic, because in your report, you identify, and Luisa, I think, already mentioned it before, you identify the 2007 IPCC Fourth Assessment Report as Neong's defining moment, particularly his role as the lead author for the Africa chapter. So I would like to ask you, what was it about his contribution that was so significant? And how did this experience change the way African climate vulnerability was understood?
So Neong was the lead author for the Africa chapter, and this was groundbreaking because it put Africans' vulnerability on the global map. Just for context, the 2007 IPCC, which was the fourth assessment report, at the time was the most comprehensive report that we had on climate effects and climate change. And so it was a really, really important document in the global community. This report showed how droughts, water scarcity, agriculture decline were intensifying due to climate change. And most importantly, it reframed Africa, not as just a passive victim, but also as a place that needs tailored community-driven adaptation. What was also really nice about Neong's contribution was his advocacy, for example, for integrating indigenous knowledge, like traditional water harvesting or drought prediction. And again, he's putting after not as just a victim, but also as a player in this fight against climate change, and one that has a lot to offer. This report also went to win the Nobel Peace Prize that year with Al Gore. And this amplified his profile, Anthony Neong, and also opened doors for him, leading to major initiatives at the AFDB.
Well, this really feels like a defining moment in his career, especially because I think he, but you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he got his position at the African Development Bank right after. And in the report, you also discuss three major climate solutions Neong has promoted: the African Development Bank's Climate Change Action Plan, the African Carbon Markets Initiative, and the Mission 300 Program for Energy Access. So let's start with the African Development Bank's Climate Change Action Plan. As Director for Climate Change and Green Growth, Neong helped in leading and implementing the plan, which aim to include low carbon development, adaptation planning, and climate risk assessments into the bank's larger development strategy. So what are some of the most significant aspects and initiatives of the plan, and how do you assess its real impact?
Okay, thank you. So first, about the comment, it was really, he started his journey in the African Development Bank after the not much after the report. However, he would only go into his official today position as Director of Climate Change and Green Growth a bit later in 2018. So about the question that was just asked, what makes it significant is that it fundamentally just changed how the bank approaches climate action. So if, rather than just treating like climate change as an isolated issue, Neong pushed with this policy to mainstream it into every single investment the bank makes, which is huge. This counted for infrastructure, agriculture, urban development, whatever. So the plan focused on four priorities. The first one was it aimed to build institutional capacity across different African governments so they could design their climate resilient infrastructure and policies. Again, here we're talking about a whole continent which has a diverse of context and circumstances. So it was really important that this was tailored, and also to empower the local governments to be able to do this. Second, another pillar was this policy made it a requirement for climate screening for all AFDB projects. We're again talking about that into just making it, instead of a peripheral problem, something that's very central and a worry for when we're talking about all investments. Any new investment then had to account for climate risk, opportunity, etc. Third, Neong also led efforts to raise $5 billion annually in climate finance. So this is tapping into international funding mechanisms such as the Green Climate Fund. Finally, and fourth, the plan also supported the African countries' NDCs, which is the nationally determined contributions, which is under the Paris Agreement. And this helps translate climate pledges into practical projects. So when you're talking about the real impact of the CCAP, I think it's nice if we take a project, a flagship project, to analyze it. So Desert to Power was a bold initiative to turn the Sahel into a renewable energy powerhouse and just do large-scale solar projects. It aimed to reach alone 250 million people and cut 30 million tons of CO2 emissions annually. So by 2019, 70% of AFDB's new projects included built-in adaptation measures, and this shows how the bank's mindset was shifting. Also, very important, Niang emphasizes balance, so ensuring equal focus on adaptation and mitigation. So adaptation is adapting according to climate change necessities, and mitigation is once a crisis occurs, you mitigate the effects. In the global context that we now live in, adaptation funding is often neglecting focus on just mitigation of crisis. So it was really, a shift again in perspective. AFDB became one of the few, very few institutions to achieve parity between adaptation and mitigation. So it dedicates nearly 60% of its climate finance to adaptation by 2023. And this just shows Neong's commitment not only to reduce the emissions, which is really important, but also to make the communities in Africa more resilient and, let's just say, future-proof.
Well, thank you, Luisa. And now I would like to move to the second policy that you analyze in the report, which is the African Carbon Markets Initiative. Officially launched at the COP27 in 2022, this initiative had the ambitious objective of expanding Africa's involvement in voluntary carbon markets. And this is kind of a difficult topic, at least it was for me when I first approached it. So I would like to ask you if you could just explain to our audience what this initiative consists of, what voluntary carbon markets are, what is the vision behind it, and what are some of its early results.
So before we dive in to the policy itself, I think it's nice if we give a little bit of context on what carbon markets are, which is basically a system that will allow for organizations and people and companies to buy and sell carbon credits. And this is to represent the reduction or removal even of greenhouse gas emissions. So they put a price on a carbon, and people that don't use this carbon can sell to other companies that are using too much carbon, basically. And this way we offset emissions. So this is something that's been happening already in place all around the world. And Africa has been historically left out of this market. So this policy aims to make a more inclusive space for these African countries within voluntary carbon markets. And it's really important because Africa has really vast natural resources, like the forest is in the Congo Basin, and this could generate huge amounts of carbon credits. And here we're really connecting development to climate change adaptation and mitigation, because this could also provide African economies and organizations with vast amounts of money. So the ASMI's goals is to produce 300 million high quality carbon credits every year by 2030. And this will generate $6 billion in revenue and create 30 million jobs. So it has a very big impact in the development of the continent. But Nyong's perspective and vision for this goes way beyond just these numbers. He wants to ensure that these markets, these carbon markets, actually benefit the African communities. So it can support projects like regenerative farming in Kenya, mangrove restoration in Mozambique, and fire management in Zambia. These aren't just about carbon sequestration. They also create local jobs, restore ecosystems, and just improve livelihoods for whole families. A key part of the success of this policy is also its focus on building local infrastructure for certification and verification. So it doesn't rely on expensive and very often inaccessible international standards. So Nyong pushes for a continental framework, which will reduce costs and also ensure African ownership of the whole process. This will partner with African Union and all other regional bodies to harmonize regulations and also just create a very transparent, trustworthy market system that will encourage investment in these markets. Results are very early on, but they have been very promising. Pilot projects are already underway, and there has been growing investor interest, which is really positive. Nyong argues for a very long time that Africa's environmental contributions, like forests, soil carbons, are very undervalued globally. And this is just this policy will ensure that Africa participates in the carbon market and also becomes a key player. And giving local communities a way of reaping financial and social benefits.
Thank you for explaining, firstly, what carbon markets are. I think that was super useful for our listeners, and why this policy is so important and it contributes, as you explained, to the involvement of the African continent in these markets. And in the report, you also discuss the so-called Mission 300 program, an initiative launched in April 2024 by the World Bank Group and the African Development Bank. Its objective is basically to provide 300 million people in Africa with access to electricity by 2030. How do they plan to reach this ambitious goal, and what has been the impact of the initiative so far?
Okay, so as you said, Nicolas, it was launched in 2024 as a partnership between the African Development Bank and the World Bank. Its goal is simple, but it's transformative. It aims to provide 300 million Africans with access to electricity by 2030. The plan combines large-scale grid expansion with decentralized renewable energy solutions like solar home systems and mini-grids. So far, around half of the target population will be connected through national grids, while the rest, especially those in rural or remote areas, will gain power through off-grid solutions. Neong often emphasizes that the future of energy in Africa is not just about building more power plants, but about building smarter, cleaner, and more inclusive energy systems. Mission 300 also prioritizes clean cooking technologies, which are essential for reducing the deadly indoor air pollution caused by firewood and charcoal stoves, of course. And this has huge health benefits, particularly for women and children, and also reduces deforestation. One of the program's innovation is the Green Finance Navigator, a digital platform that connects local energy projects with international investors based on risk tolerance and project needs. We feel this is key because financing has always been a bottleneck for energy access in Africa. And even though it's still early, Mission 300 is already mobilizing billions in funding and supporting national energy compacts across like Kenya and Nigeria and Ethiopia. And for NEON, this initiative isn't just about electricity. It's about unlocking opportunities for people, for example, giving better health, better education, and the ability for small business and startups to thrive. So it's energy as a foundation for development, climate resilience, and long-term prosperity. It has guided like through the path of this policy, which is Mission 300.
Well, this really seems like an important policy as well, but I think the three of them, it was really interesting to analyze them since they have like different goals, but still together they form part of this larger strategy by the African Development Bank and how NEONG led this process. It's really interesting to look at how all these different climate policies are integrated into a unique framework at the African Development Bank. And we almost made it to the end of the episode. I just have one question left. And this is a question that I always ask to the guests in this series. So they researched, as you did, for 9 weeks, I think, a singular climate leader, in this case, Anthony Neong. And after 9 weeks of researching this person, I always want to know if, in your own words, do you believe he is truly a climate leader? And beyond that, why should the world pay attention to his work right now?
Okay, so absolutely, without a doubt, Neong is not only a climate leader, but a visionary for what development-centered climate action can look like. I think we're talking for both of us. We think he bridges the gap between local realities and global climate finance, ensuring Africa's voice is heard. So his approach shows that tackling climate change can also reduce poverty, and it could also empower youth and build long-term resilience. We feel his work at the African Development Bank shows that effective climate leadership must integrate science, of course, and it must develop priorities and local realities. We also believe if more policies, particularly in vulnerable regions like Africa, were shaped by individuals with both scientific expertise and an understanding of development, global climate action will be more effective and, of course, more sustainable.
Well, thank you very much, girls. This has been an incredible episode. I really loved it, and I think I learned something as well. And definitely, I agree with you. Anthony Neong is definitely a climate leader. And thank you very much for explaining it to us today. I think that with this, we can end today's episode. And thank you very much again to Luis and Sara for joining me today. This has been the sixth and last episode of our series as part of the IERIA Summer Research Program of 2025. To our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out Luis and Sara's report at riagroup.org and to follow us on social media to receive updates on new articles and contents. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.